Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined once again by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And don't worry, this isn't going to be all Matt's all the time, but Matthew Leyland has stepped up to the plate once more. And we're also going to be joined by some very special guests this week. We've got three interviews. There's going to be Jeffrey Wright, who'll be talking about his role in American Fiction. Ludvig Göransson is talking about scoring Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. And director Sean Durkin is chatting about his new wrestling movie, The Iron Claw. If you want to jump straight to any of those interviews now, we've got the timing cues in the show notes. But also this week, we're going to be reviewing The Iron Claw, as well as Steve McQueen's new documentary, Occupied City, and crime drama Gassed Up. And we'll also be just mentioning a few re-releases you can also find in the cinema this week. But before we get onto those, what have you been up to this week, Matthew?
Well, I went to the London Film Critics Circle Awards on Sunday with your good self.
Yeah.
That was an exciting do. It was interesting to see All of Us Strangers and Zone of Interest kind of sweep the board between them with some, there were some big hitters that didn't really get a look in. I mean, notably Barbenheimer, multiple nominations, but not a single win for either of those films. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to see how this kind of plays out, well, especially with the BAFTAs coming up and the Oscars. It was a good do. I mean, it's always a good do, but yeah, it was very enjoyable. Lots of sort of good speeches.
I actually presented an award this time
you
as
did.
Well. Presented the Best Actress, Actress of the Year, which went to Emma Stone, who sadly wasn't there, but did have a very nice video message.
Yeah,
so that was good fun. That's what I've been up to. I don't know if I've actually really watched much else besides the films, you know, this week's films, but long-term listeners will know that we watch, I watch a lot of Bluey in my house, and we'd sort of been like portioning out the new episodes that have been released earlier this year and finally finished those at the weekend. So completely up to date on Bluey now, which is a quite kind of good and bad thing. I always like having a few more in the tank, knowing I can sort of turn to them if needed, but you know, yeah, just time to start over again. And there is supposed to be like an extra long episode of Bluey coming this year, because they're all about like 7 or 8 minutes is the standard, but there's supposed to be like a 20 something minute special episode coming at some point this year, but I have no idea when.
There's got to be a movie, surely. I mean, given how successful it is, it's huge.
You'd think. And just the kind of crossover parent appeal that it's had, it's got to be thinking about it. So, but before we actually get on to talking about the new releases this week, let's hear from Jeffrey Wright, because he was actually honoured with an achievement award, the Dilys Powell Award, at the London Critics Circle Film Awards we were just talking about. So here he's talking about his new film American Fiction, which has been nominated for tons of awards, and he's been nominated for tons of awards as well, including Best Actor at the upcoming Oscars. We spoke about that film in more detail on last week's episode, if you want to go back and listen to that review. But to briefly set it up, in American Fiction, Wright plays Thelonious Monk Ellison, who's an academic and author who hasn't found the career success he's hoped for. But when he sort of sarcastically writes a parody of the kind of stereotypical book he loathes, he finds unexpected success with it. Here's what Jeffrey had to say when our online entertainment editor, Emily Murray, caught up with him last week.
Thank you.
Monk, your books are good, but they're not popular.
Editors, they want a black book.
They have a black book. I'm black, and it's my book.
You know what I mean.
Look at what they published. Look at what they expect us to write.
I just want to rub their noses in it.
Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
I absolutely loved it. I showed it to my dad as well, and he said it's the best one we've seen in years.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so he's a big fan, and he's like, it's really funny when you do these interviews and you're like, who do your parents get excited about? Well, Jeffrey Wright, American Fiction.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you, Dad. I've heard that from a fair amount of people who've seen it themselves and then decided to see it with
to
family.
Share it.
Yeah.
Well, it's a family story.
It is.
Isn't it? And is that something that drew you to the role then? Because I understand that I was reading an interview that you'd never had such a family-centric film, I guess, and role before.
Yeah, never. When we were filming this, I looked around and I said, this is all brand new to me. And it's also, I think, a family that we don't often see portrayed in film. Certainly not one that's populated by a group of actors like myself and Tracy Ellis Ross and Sterling K. Brown and Leslie Uggams. You know, we're clearly black folks, but it's a family that's like anyone's family. Mm. It's crazed at times. It's beautiful at times. We put the fun in dysfunction, like all families. And there's a humanness to it that's really, I think, wonderful. And also inviting to people across backgrounds to find themselves within. We don't see this a lot. And the family aspect, yes, was the aspect that I most felt connected with, owing to experiences that I was having when I received the script, trying to be the adult in the room of my family following my mother's passing. You know, she passed about a year or so before I got the script. So I had the good fortune of being raised by two women, my mother and her eldest sister, my aunt, who's now 94, who came to live with us after my mom passed. And that was shortly before the pandemic, and I have two kids. And so, man, there were all these pressures that many of us were experiencing at that time. And that's where our character finds himself very early on in our film, trying to, by, you know, whatever means, keep the family together and to play caretaker to his mother.
Yeah.
Which, again, is a very moving aspect of this film, I think, that's unexpected and also one that people have experienced and feel validated by when they see the film.
I watched a beautiful video recently of you reacting to your Oscar nomination and talking about how the first person you thanked, you know, was your mum. It was very emotional and it must be a big deal. Yeah. Like, so how is the film then a homage to her? Because I think you said that your son is the one who clocked that.
The emotional heart of the film is my character Monk's relationship to his mother. And that's driving, not entirely, but to a large extent, a significant extent anyway, some of the choices that he makes. Yes, he writes this book out of a sense of outrage, this kind of farcical, dismissive book that he thinks is beneath him, but he writes as a joke to kind of show up the hypocrisy of the publishing industry, whereas the books that he wants to write are not received well. He does that out of a sense of spite, yes. It leads him to leading this absurd double life because he writes the book under a pseudonym, so he has to play this character, Stagar Lee, that's based on this reference to a pimp caricature of the 19th century in America. But he does all of this as well out of a sense of responsibility to his mother and to his family. That's the nucleus of the story. And I think my son felt that. He saw that. And he also recognized, too, that my daughter as well, when she saw it, that this character's a lot like me. My daughter said, you know, there's a lot of your humor in there. Anybody who knows me goes, yeah, that's pretty much you, dude.
And kids know you best, of course.
Yeah, they do.
So it is a personal role for you. Did you discover anything new about yourself then whilst making it?
Yeah, it's been one of the more, you know, self-reflective experiences that I've had working on this film, and then also talking about it and bringing it to audiences. It's only when the audience receives it that you kind of begin to resolve your understanding of what the film is. It's not like the theater where you have a relationship, you know, an immediate relationship with the audience. Here it comes a little bit later, and that's when the picture is complete. And then, of course, you know, all of the attention that the film's been getting, been asked to talk about myself a lot. Talk about why you wanted to do this movie. You know, the similarities, you know, you've mentioned. Go tell us more. Some of them are good. Some of them are less fortunate. Some of his tendencies tend to be, well, you know, he's a bit of a misanthrope. You know, he's a bit angry. He's reasonably funny, reasonably smart. You know, he's also kind of self-destructive, you know, when it comes to relationships particularly. I think I understand a bit of that. So, I've discovered some things that maybe I need to work through. At the same time, what I love about this film is that there's a hopefulness in it, particularly in his journey, in that he's not the same man at the end of the film that he was in the beginning.
Yeah.
He's capable of positive self-criticism, self-analysis, and he's growing. He's evolving. There's hope in that. I think it's a valuable thing, not only for individuals, but also for humans as a whole. We tend to not be so skillful at self-analysis. We tend to make the same mistakes time after time. We see that now, like, happening in the world.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a little message of hope in that with this guy, that he's going, you know, maybe I can do this better.
As you said, it's a beautiful, layered script. And I know Cole Jefferson has said that he only ever pictured you for the role. Does that like add any pressure when you're reading it? Because I think he said there's no plan B. It's you or nothing.
No, that takes off the pressure.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about anybody else, like, you know, hovering around the thing. It's like, yeah, okay, cool. And it also shows, you know, a level of appreciation for, you know, what I've done in the past and what I might do. So, no, that feels good. And when I read the script, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, this is a smart script. There's a lot to chew on here. Met Cord, smart guy. He saw a lot of overlaps with his life when he read the book, Percival Everett's Erasure, that the script is based on. So it was really about the possibilities for really wonderful collaboration. Okay, yeah, I get this. Let's do it.
And as you said, it's an outstanding cast. I found it funny online when I read that Leslie, who plays your mum, is someone you had a crush on.
Yeah.
Growing up. Did you tell her that?
Oh, yeah, I told her that.
What did she say?
Yeah, she loved that. She says, I may be old, but I'm not dead. So she, she loved it. Yeah, I mean, I saw her from a kid. She used to have a variety show, like when I was 4 or 5 years old. And I'd look at her and go, oh, wow, who's this woman? Wow, she's, you know, she was so graceful and so talented, like supremely talented, beautiful singing voice. And, you know, she would perform with Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr., you know, the Rat Pack, Dean Martin, all those guys. So she goes from the Rat Pack to Roots. You know, she begins her career in the early 50s winning the talent show at the Apollo Theater, and she's still doing it now, you know? She's one of those people of that generation or those generations of people, performers, who came before me and Sterling and Tracy and Issa and Erica, who make everything that we do possible. You know, we have a certain creative freedom and agency now because of the incredible toughness and brilliance of those folks and the work that they did. Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, Eartha Kitt, all of those incredible performers. And Leslie is representative of those folks. Yeah. Hell yeah, I had a crush on her.
Can I just squeeze in this one last question?
Yes.
Sorry. Because I can't not ask you about something which I'm very excited for. One of my favorite roles of yours is actually in The Last of Us, in the game. Is that something you'd ever like to reprise on screen? Because I know they're casting for season 2 right now.
Anything's possible.
But see, so you'd like to then?
We shall see.
That's Jeffrey Wright talking American Fiction, which is out now. So on to new releases now. Expect an emotional body slam from this film.
Ever since I was a child, people said my family was cursed. Mom tried to protect us with God. Pop tried to protect us with wrestling. He said if we were the toughest, the strongest, nothing could ever hurt us. I believed him. We all did.
This is The Iron Claw, a real-life wrestling drama based on the Von Erich family and set in the late 70s and 80s. And Zac Efron stars as Kevin Von Erich, and he's one of a family of wrestlers. There's his brothers, played by Jeremy Allen White, Harris Dickinson, and Stanley Simons, who are also training to be wrestlers. And they're all doing it under the tutelage of their father, Fritz, who's played by Holt McCallany. As well as being this kind of, you know, this wrestling drama, kind of sports, some sort of sports movie element to it, they're also contending with this sense that their family is cursed. That kind of looms over the film as well. But before we review the film and dive into it, here's what director Sean Durkin, who has also previously directed Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene and The Nest, had to say when I caught up with him last week.
Together, we can do anything.
We're here to restore justice to the Wrestling Federation that our father built with his own two hands. The hands that were passed down to us. The hands that will deliver the Iron Claw to you.
Wrestling's been quite a big deal in the UK for quite a long time, as you probably know, because you spent a lot of time here in the 80s, didn't you?
Yeah.
Growing up. But I'd say the Von Erich family are perhaps not that well known over here. Their story's not that well known. Are they more like household names in the States?
Or? No, definitely not household names. And I actually discovered them when I lived here. I used to go and find like old VHS tapes of territorial wrestling. And so I had some best of NWA matches and I saw them for the first time on there. And then I think I got a copy of Parade of Champions, which was a big event they put on when David died. So yeah, I discovered them when I was here. And then I saw Kerry live a few times because he was in the WWF in the early 90s. And I actually saw him for the first time at the Royal Albert Hall.
How long had you actually been thinking about this story as a film then, as opposed to just that childhood interest?
So in 2015, I had the idea.
With casting this family, sort of, was that at the forefront of your mind when you were sort of putting together the script? Were you kind of thinking about how that family was going
to
work?
I don't tend to write with people in mind. I wasn't necessarily thinking about who could be in it. But at a, you know, at a certain point, you change gears. But Zach was definitely someone I've been interested in general for about 10 years. Mm. You know, he was naturally kind of top of the list because of that, I think, once we did start talking.
And what was that process like of bringing him on board? Was he sort of, was it an easy process? Was yeah. he into it right away?
It was. It was very direct. We had a meeting just to meet each other before there was any, before he read any script or anything, just so I could tell him what it was about and we could just talk. And we got along really well. And I just saw, you know, he has this real sweetness to him. Mm. And that was a real, really a core part of Kevin's character. It's this kind of kind, sweet side. And I was really... needed an actor to have that inherently, I think, especially with, you know, Kevin's quite a quiet, passive lead character. So he's quite unconventional in that way. So that trait really had to be in him.
And so then is he the first and you're kind of building this family around him? Is that how?
Yeah. I mean, I had Holt in mind for Fritz probably even before Zach, but we sort of secured Zach first and he was really the center point. You know, the cast was like a bunch of people I'd wanted to work with. So I'd wanted to work with Harris since seeing him in Beach Rats, you know. And so, you know, I've known Jeremy forever since he was 15 years old. So, you know, it was just like this series of reaching out to people who I wanted to work with and putting them together around Zach and imagining they would have chemistry based on my conversations with them.
And you mentioned Holt, who a lot of people probably know best from Mindhunter. Mm-hmm. Was that what you knew? Did you know from that before this? Is that
no? That's what I saw him in.
Yeah. And what was it you liked about him for this sort of patriarch?
I mean, in that show, he's so incredible. He's so believable as this person of this place and time. Mm. I just love that character. The way he's sort of at the forefront of this new method, but absolutely also of the sort of previous school, you know. And he just wears it. He just like wears the era, you know. He's so believable in the era, and I think that was one of the things. And just physically, it has a lot of resemblance and charisma. You know, he's very charismatic, and Fritz is very charismatic.
And the cast, like Zach and Jeremy, they have to get into insane shape for this. Like, is that a discussion you have sort of early doors with them, or do they sort of take it upon themselves just to get into it, to get fully into these characters?
No, we didn't really need to talk about it because it's sort of an obvious thing about taking on the role. We talked more about the wrestling, and I was involved in the wrestling training and getting them to the level, yeah, where they could wrestle full matches and things. But the physical transformation, you know, there's not many humans on the face of the planet like Cary Von Erich, never mind actors. So we're never going to match the real Cary Von Erich. Jeremy and I talked a little bit about that. It's more like you do what feels right for you physically and use it as your way into the character, and that's that.
And does it ever get competitive with these guys when they're sort of bulking up and training together? Is there ever any kind of trying to outdo each other?
I didn't see any. It was very supportive. I'm sure there's a level of healthy, not competition, but just like, okay, you've learned to do that move. It's like inspiring. I'm going to learn to do that move, or I'm going to do a different move, you know? So I think because the level was high, that they were all, it was sort of like pushing them all up a level, but it certainly wasn't competitive.
The wrestling scenes, how did you approach those? Were you sort of trying to recreate old matches, or were you just taking a really fresh?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I took a couple of old matches and sort of put them in the context of our narrative. So it was almost like I adapted old matches for the script and put them in a place that they weren't necessarily in like a, from a character standpoint for the real Kevin, like they weren't necessarily in that place in his life, but I took the real match and sort of put it in the film and was able to use it as a, like a narrative tool to propel the story forward. Ultimately, I was just sort of wrote the matches originally from just imagining a match. I'd spent so much time thinking about wrestling as a kid and so much time playing with wrestling toys and like building this extensive world that I just, you know, knew how to write wrestling, I guess. And so it came really naturally. And then, and like with any collaborator, Chavo Guerrero, who's our wrestling coach, and he and I worked together the way I'd work with, you know, my DP or designer, where I give him the script, he'd come in and be like, okay, well, let's, you know, this is good, let's try and let's tweak this to that, or, you know, he'd know that, he'd start to know the actors, he's like, okay, well, Zach's really good at coming off the top rope, so let's use that. I'd send Chavo like a move, I'd be like, look at this old move that I found Kevin doing, you know, like the step up, the where he does that crazy step up the rope, like headlock flip thing. I don't even know what it's called. And I send that to Chavo. I was like, can we get Zach to do this? He's like, yeah, Zach can definitely do that. And like, it was that back and forth to build it.
Well, it sounds like, was it kind of easier to put together those scenes than you'd imagined? Or were there kind of challenges?
There was nothing easy about it. I mean, but it was fun. You know, it was fun and it was thrilling too. There's an adrenaline to putting on a live spectacle like that, which I hadn't experienced in shooting. We had audiences, we were wrestling a full match, so the crowd was like fully into it. So it's hard, and there's different challenges to a sort of more normal scene. So in some ways it is really different, in other ways it's just like any other scene.
Obviously you had that knowledge of wrestling to begin with, but in your research, did you learn anything about wrestling that sort of really surprised you, or was it all just already in there?
Nothing that surprised me, but more of just deepening the understanding. You know, you can understand things on a surface level. You're like, okay, these guys are on the road 300 nights a year. Their life is really hard. Their job is really physical. Like, they're wrestling through pain. They're ignoring injuries. And when they get injured, they're laid off, essentially. You know, there's no protections. There's things about, like, the lifestyle. But then when you go and you stand in the ring and you try to bounce off the ropes yourself and you watch what they do, it deepens the understanding of how physical and how painful it is. Like, the simplest thing is painful. Bouncing off the ropes, like, I couldn't bounce off the ropes once. Like, they're steel cables wrapped in a bit of tape. Like, it's your back bruises. It's really something. And so it was just like deepening my understanding of how difficult of a life it is.
We were kind of blown away by this film at Total Film. Like, we absolutely loved it. And we kind of expected it to get like a raft of awards nominations, but sadly that hasn't really quite materialized. Was that something, like, were you kind of hoping for that?
It's not something that I think about when making. Very focused on the making. And the reaction has been so overwhelmingly positive, both from, you know, critics, audiences, done extremely well in the US, the box office, you know, all those things. So there's all these positives, and that's all great. And then once awards stuff starts to come out and the film is overlooked, then it starts to, like, you know, eat at you a bit, because it doesn't quite make sense. Like, if you compare it on quality on every level, it's like doesn't make sense that it gets left out. Like, you can put Zach up against any performance of the year. It doesn't make sense. So, but look, I mean, I've been there before and I'll be there again. It's a part of it. So
there's this idea of the Von Erich curse, which kind of permeates the film. And it was something that when I saw the film, I knew that there was this idea of the curse, but I didn't really know much about the detail of it. Like, how much do you sort of expect audiences to know going in? Would you kind of prefer people to not know a great deal about the real story? Or
no, it doesn't really matter. It's you can go in knowing everything about wrestling and enjoy all of the details. Like, I put a lot of little, you know, hidden gems in there that you might know or not know, and it doesn't affect the story. Or you can go in knowing nothing about wrestling, caring nothing about wrestling. It's a family story. It's a character piece about one guy's survival. You know, the curse is this element that presents itself in the film as one thing, but it's really something else. It's much more psychological. It's much more emotional. And it's just the journey. And so I personally go to movies knowing nothing. I don't watch trailers. I sort of have a sense of what it's about, and then I'll go see it. So I always encourage people to know less. But it's sort of, with this one, it was unique in that you could go in knowing everything or go in knowing nothing. And my hope is that it wouldn't affect your experience.
And you mentioned kind of about the Easter eggs and stuff for wrestling fans. Like, as someone who grew up like a reasonable wrestling fan, I was very excited when I saw Ric Flair in there. And it was kind of like, I felt like how probably a lot of people feel in like comic book movies when a certain character turns up. But was that a tricky role to cast?
Not really. I had worked with Aaron Dean Eisenberg last year on a TV show called Dead Ringers, and he came in and did an episode for me where, he just played this character that had this level of madness, and I just saw him there and I was like, oh, I want him to bring, you know, that madness to my Ric Flair. And so, and also Kevin Anton, who plays Harley Race. So it was the same. It was also, he had a small part in Dead Ringers, and I sort of recognized something in that too. So it was like any role. It's just like finding that piece of a character that, or piece of an actor, an energy from an actor you recognize is right for that, for what you need that piece of the character to be like.
And did you have much interaction with the Von Erich family in the sort of making of the film and in the research?
Yeah, not so much in the research. There was a lot out there. A lot of published interviews, a lot of documentaries, a lot of, you know, in-depth interviews from Kevin. I felt like there was enough out there to base it on, and it allowed me to keep some distance emotionally when deciding what would and wouldn't be in the film. And then once I knew what the movie was and I could stand behind the decisions, then I reached out to Kevin to, you know, say we're making the film and this is what it's about and this is what I've chosen to focus on and this is why, and talk him through it. And then we developed a great relationship, and yeah, we started talking, and we've become quite close in the last year.
And this is your third feature, obviously, after Martha Marcy, May Marlene and The Nest. Do you kind of see through lines with these films, or do you not analyze your work that way?
No, I think they're really clear through lines. I mean, they're all about family, and they're all about unusual families, each in their own way. They're all about the ways that we communicate within families or do not communicate. They all question why we believe what we believe on some level. And I think they also all, you know, in some ways critique or examine the American dream. So I think there's a lot.
So, Ironclaw, we've already set it up a little bit, Matthew. Tell me what you thought of this film.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was kind of vaguely aware of the Von Erich family because my son is a huge wrestling fan. So I'd seen like pictures and references in his various wrestling encyclopedias. But I had no kind of idea of the depth of their story. And it's kind of got a sort of Shakespearean tragedy kind of element to it, really. I mean, it really is one of those stranger than fiction stories. I think you might kind of be slightly disbelieving of it if this was a kind of a made up story because of all the misfortune and bad luck that this family goes through, all these brothers, one after another. I mean, don't want to get too much into spoilers as to what happens, because there's some quite sort of big shocks here, which are sort of handled really well. But yeah, this is very much not your kind of typical feel-good underdog sports movie, although it does have those kind of elements. It, you know, it celebrates their success and their commitment, their dedication, their prowess in the ring. But very much it is a family drama where the family is really, really put through the ringer. So yeah, it's a much more kind of a perhaps emotional movie, more challenging maybe than you might be expecting from, you know, the posters of these of kind of like these big oiled up muscle men that are all over the publicity, particularly Zac Efron. I thought it was absolutely terrific. I mean, I've loved Sean Durkin's previous movies, particularly The Nest. And I mean, he really has such a great handle on family dynamics, really kind of how everybody kind of interacts, how they play off each other. He doesn't kind of leave anybody out. Everybody gets an arc. And I mean, he's really kind of sensitive to the sort of the emotional ups and downs they go through. And I mean, there's a lot of potential here for kind of camp humor and excess, which does play a part. You know, you never get the sense he's kind of mocking or ridiculing or sort of tipping into over the top melodrama with this. So certainly I thought Zac Efron's best performance that I've seen him give in a movie. I thought he was absolutely terrific playing this character. He's kind of the center of the movie, if there is one. Kevin, especially as this character, I mean, he's very likable, but he's not sort of as naturally charismatic as some of his brothers. He kind of struggles a bit with the more sort of the public side of wrestling. So that's quite a tricky thing to pull off, to play someone who is a bit more sort of withdrawn and internal. So yeah, I highly recommend this. Thought it was terrific.
Yeah, he's a very sort of sweet, low-key character, isn't he? And pretty much agree with just everything you said, really. And obviously, we kind of touched on the interview with the kind of similarities with Sean Durkin's previous films, which again, I've all sort of really enjoyed. The Nest particularly is a particularly sort of quite underrated film of recent years, isn't it? That's definitely worth seeking that out if you haven't seen it. But yeah, I just agree. I just absolutely love this film. And again, we say this a lot at this time of year because, you know, we're getting the kind of, a you know, awards contenders, even though this one was kind of sadly didn't really make much of an awards impact like I sort of expected it might do, especially for Zac Efron. Because it's kind of, you know, obviously been geared up to be released in that awards window. We often get in the UK, we get these films later. So they, you know, we get them in January, February, rather than the end of the previous year. But it means that I see a lot of films early this year that I think, oh, this is going to be one of my favorite films of the year. So I'd be surprised if this isn't, like, you know, doing well on my sort of top 10 or top five of the year by the end of the year, because yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I came to it with really zero knowledge about this family at all. I was kind of, you know, moderate wrestling fan when I was younger. So I had that kind of, I enjoyed it when Ric Flair pops up briefly here. And so obviously there were certain elements that were familiar and, you know, like kind of, you know, just even just the fighting style and, you know, the time in the ring. I appreciated all that, but I didn't know this family at all. Didn't know this story. And I was vaguely aware of the curse as well, but didn't really know what it entailed or why. But yeah, I just absolutely loved the film and loved the soundtrack. Was kind of just gripped throughout. It's sort of, there is a weird, almost like paranormal quality, like hanging over it in a strange way because of everything that happens and goes on, and just the sort of drama there. I loved Holt McCallany's performance as well as the patriarch of the family. Yeah, he was another one I would have predicted I thought we would be seeing him in the sort of supporting actor race, but he was a bit overlooked there as well. I also just found it like really moving, and it really sort of stuck with me. And again, without going into any sort of details, there's just a couple of elements towards the end, that a couple of moments that just I found like extremely moving, and they just like really, really stuck with me afterwards. Like I just kind of couldn't get the sort of those moments out of my head, really. Yeah. So
there's a kind of element of, I don't know if you'd call it magic realism, which could have gone quite badly if it hadn't been pulled off in a sensitive way or seemed slightly almost comical. But yeah, it's incredibly moving, this really unexpected moment towards the end. Yeah, it does have a real emotional kick to it, this movie.
Despite, like you say, there is some funny wrestling moments and some you know, campy bits you'll kind of appreciate, but it's a very intense film at the same time, and very sort of emotionally rewarding. So that's a strong recommend from both of us, and that is The Iron Claw, which is in cinemas from Friday. Next up is the new project from celebrated artist and filmmaker Steve McQueen.
All streetlights were turned off. Dutch organisations were Nazified or forbidden. Soon, the Nazis started to ban Jews from parks, pools, shops, cafes and schools, from all public life. Music by Jewish composers could no longer be played. In 1941, they started rounding people up. In 1942, the deportations began.
Matthew, that's Occupied City. Could you introduce this film for us, please?
Yeah, so this is the latest film from Steve McQueen. It's a 4.5-hour documentary, and it's based on the book Atlas of an Occupied City, Amsterdam, 1940 to 1945, which is written by his wife, Bianca Stigter. The documentary, all the footage is of present-day Amsterdam, but with a voiceover kind of recounting, telling us what happened in all these very various locations around the city in the course of the Second World War. So it's kind of double layered. So what you're seeing is the modern Amsterdam, but what you're hearing is its past. So it's quite a challenging thing to do, because in your mind's eye, you're constantly trying to see the past as it was, as it's being described, but with your physical eye, you're seeing how things are today. It covers quite a lot of ground of the past few years. Like we see there's climate protests and there's COVID lockdowns. We see like lockdown rules being broken. We see people kind of at work, at play, you know, and obviously it does cover a huge amount of ground over these 4.5 hours, and always with this constant voiceover telling you what had happened. Each kind of vignette of description of a place will often end with telling you that this place was demolished or partly demolished. And so it kind of goes on like that.
From the way you've described it, it sort of sounds almost more like it has like a more of an art installation feel than a feature film. Is that sort of fair to say?
Yeah, I think it is the kind of thing. Yeah, you can very much imagine it being projected in a gallery and something that you could sort of dip in and out of. There's not so many sort of, I mean, there are a few through lines, but there's not sort of like characters as such or, it kind of explores as much territory as possible. It kind of goes for a real sort of breadth. The kind of the point, I mean, even though, yeah, it's challenging, it's quite an endurance test to sit through a 4.5 hour movie, but the kind of the point that I feel like it's really making is that just how much history is embedded in, even the most kind of innocuous looking place. If you really kind of dug into the history of any place, of any city, but yeah, particularly one like this that's been affected by these huge events, just how big the legacy is and what sort of mark is left behind on all of it, how much an occupation can really affect every single part of a city. So it feels like it's sort of justified in that sense. It's kind of a big ask for audiences to, give up 4.5 hours in a cinema. So
I mean,
how
there is
much
an
of a,
intermission at least, isn't there? I mean,
yeah,
it's
it's a
actually
15-minute
a rare
intermission.
modern film that has an intermission. But I mean,
Yeah.
it's got sort of mixed reviews in the sense that, like, I mean, it's got some extremely strong reviews and then some more negative ones as well. But did it kind of have like an emotional impact ultimately for you, or was it more that it was kind of, interesting on a sort of cerebral level, but did it kind of connect emotionally in some way?
In both ways. I mean, the voiceover is kind of detached in a way. It's, it kind of lays out the facts, which I think is kind of the sort of sensible approach when you're dealing with something on this scale. Right, if it was kind of really sort of hitting you all the time with the emotional impact. I mean, that there's no sort of incidental, there's no soundtrack to it, so it's not kind of, you wouldn't sort of call it manipulative as such. It's pulling at the heartstrings, which I think is kind of the right approach. It's just kind of laying out, this is what happened. You bring your own kind of feelings and emotions to it. Yeah, and there are some very poignant moments and some funny moments as well. I mean, and quite joyful moments, especially those bits where you see people sort of frolicking in the snow, and getting on their sleds, things like that. And there's a few sort of moments where Steve McQueen uses drone cameras that kind of drift through the city. Those are kind of quite lyrical, pleasant visual moments as well. Perhaps as a compliment to the book, I'd imagine if you've read the book as well, then perhaps you will get more out of it. There's no doubt this is a hugely ambitious, impressive project.
And the sort of when you're seeing footage of the present day, do you hear present day, like, is there a present day sound there, or is it entirely just the voiceover talking about what happened in the past?
More sort of ambient sound, really. There's no kind of talking heads, but yeah, you hear sort of snatches of people talking. It's very much sort of fly on the wall type of stuff. You don't get interviews as such. So it is a kind of a snapshot of how the city looks at the moment, which, yeah, it's particularly fascinating when it's exploring lockdown, because obviously that's such fresh history, and we all have our own experience of that. But to see it from a different perspective, how a different city went through it, that's quite fascinating.
Okay, so that sounds like a challenging but interesting documentary. And
Yeah.
if you like the sound of that, and you've got the four and a bit hours to commit to it, that is Occupied City, which is in cinemas from Friday. And now, before we move on to our final new film of the week, here's another interview. Ludwig Göransson is the composer behind Oppenheimer's incredible score, and you'll have also have heard his work in Tenet, Creed, and The Mandalorian. He's had nominations galore for his work on Oppenheimer this award season, including at the upcoming BAFTAs and Oscars. Here's what he had to say to online entertainment editor Emily Murray when he spoke to her last week in the lead up to the BAFTAs.
BAFTA, an Oscar, just won a Golden Globe. How are you feeling about that?
Feels in incredible. Feels very honored, and just, it's been such a fun, wild ride.
You didn't expect anything like this, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, I don't expect anything really. I mean, it's just you know, the movie also came out a while ago, so, and we finished it even 6 months before the movie came out. You know, I've been living in this world now for a year or for 2 years maybe, and it's a really wonderful world and a wonderful crew to be around. So I'm just happy to be here with my friends.
I think because it's a Nolan film, everyone saw it doing well, but like, it's an R-rated 3-hour long biopic about the atomic bomb, and it's nearly $1 billion.
Yeah.
Like, what's your reaction to that? Because it's really become such a phenomenon.
It's crazy. I was in Sweden in a small little town when the movie came out, and I was going to bring my friends and my wife Serena. We were going to go see it together. And I remember the day before it came out, Serena saw some people on the bus stop dressed out in pink, and she was like, oh, are you guys going to go to Barbie? And they were like, yeah, we're so excited. And then a few blocks away, she saw three guys in like smoking and like in gray suits. And she's like, oh, are you guys going to go see Oppenheimer? And they didn't know what she was talking about.
Oh, wow.
but the day after, we went to see the movie in this little small little village, and we barely didn't get any tickets because it was sold out. And wow. I was like, and that's kind of when I realized that, okay, if for it to be sold out in that little small town, people must be very, very keen to go see this.
I remember when it came out here, because we have to be a BFI IMAX here, like people were tweeting saying they were coming from like Norway and like wow. loads of places in Europe just to come to the BFI IMAX wow. just to see Oppenheimer. And it was playing it like throughout the night as well because of the success.
Right. And then, yeah, all the IMAX screenings in LA were like sold out for months.
Did you do the Barbenheimer double bill at all?
I was not able to, no, because we were in Sweden, and we're also with our 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so we didn't have a lot of time to get out.
So this is your second film with Christopher Nolan. Mm-hmm. How would you say your work relationships evolved since, you know, you started together on Tenet, or has it changed at all?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, now when we started Oppenheimer, like, I know him, he knows me, I trust, you know, we have a trust within each other. And I also know the process better, and I know how extremely, when I start writing music, when they're in pre-production, before he shoots the film, I'm able to bring in any kind of ideas, and I throw everything at the wall. And that's one part of my favorite parts of the process, just sitting there and listening to music that I write with Chris and going over it, and going through it over and over again, and pinpointing out the details that he likes and details that we think could work for the sound world of the score, and really create our own DNA of music for the film.
He said recently that your music's the secret sauce, is the quote, for his filmmaking. Like, what's your reaction to that?
It's very, very, very flattering. It's a very collaborative process, and he's with me for the whole ride, and just his curiosity in music and his interest in it and how important it is to the story and integral part of the film. It's just such a pleasure to work with him, and I couldn't be more happy.
Is he someone, Ben, you'd always say yes to if he asked you to work with him?
Oh yeah.
Never a no.
Within a heartbeat, for sure. Yeah.
He's a very different filmmaker to others. Like, do you ever get that when you work with him, that working with him is different to, you know, how you've worked with other directors before?
Yeah, I don't work with a lot of people, and everyone have their own ways, and Chris definitely has his way of working, and I love the process.
One thing that stands out about Oppenheimer is that it was written in first person, the screenplay. So did that impact the way you tackled the score at all?
It truly did. I understood from very early on after reading the script that the music needs to portray, it needs to put the audience in Oppenheimer's shoes and make the audience feel what he's feeling and see what he's seeing. Instead of having the audience sitting there judging this character, I would have to also go to all those places emotionally that Killian did, and that Killian's portraying with Oppenheimer. And that was a very challenging journey at times.
Was it like a particular scene or moment that was like really, really tough to compose?
I would say the scene at Fuller Lodge, that was the one that took the longest time. I think we finished that piece of music the day before we wrapped the entire film. And I tried so many different ideas and concepts, and it took a long time to finally get that right and really understand what he's going through in that moment. It was very challenging. I had to go to some difficult places to try to capture that. You know, I got to have so much fun writing this music, and I also got to experiment a lot and work closely with my wife Serena, who's a very accomplished violinist, mm-hmm. and because the only idea Chris gave me really in the beginning was to use the violin to portray Oppenheimer, and he was especially interested in how, you know, the violin being such an expressive instrument, how you can go from like a very round romantic vibrato and tone to within a split second change the performance to like a neurotic, horrific, horrifying tone and go between those feelings in the same piece of music.
So Oppenheimer has a violin. You can correct me if I'm wrong here, but Strauss is the harp. Is that right?
Strauss is the harp and the Rhodes.
Yeah. So why those instruments for him? Because how do they play against each other? Because he is, I suppose, situated as the antagonist there against Oppenheimer.
Yeah, the harp and the Rhodes, the harp has this kind of sense of, I would say, mystery to it. But also the way that we use it in the beginning, the first time when Strauss is introduced, the harp is almost playing it more in the lush, kind of beautiful friendship kind of way. Mm. And then it slowly progresses into a mystery. And then, you know, obviously on the reveal of Strauss' true character, you know, it turns into a darker place.
And then Kitty's the piano, is that mm-hmm. right? Yeah, so why? Yeah, why piano for Kitty?
Just something completely different from Oppenheimer. Want to have that grounded feeling with Kitty, how she's the one, you know, keeping him grounded. And also her theme contains of these piano chords that has a lot of pauses in between. I get the feeling that she's the one kind of that is in charge of most of his actions and also the love theme, because it's those chords eventually go into the theme, her theme, and it is a waltz, and his theme goes into her theme together, and it's almost like a dance.
There's a lot of like anxiety inducing score as well, yeah. And it's interesting how you include the sound effects of the feet, mm-hmm. the feet stomping. Tell me a bit about the idea of including the noise of the feet, which I feel like does come in quite a bit.
Yeah, the noise of the feet stomps were there in the script. So when I read the script, you know, the foot stomps written down in the script. You have the 10 seconds of silence after the Trinity test in the script. Chris gave me the foot stomps as a sound design element early on to bring into the music as well. And I love working closely with sound design into the score too. And there's one point in the film where the music in the score turns completely almost into sound design when they're getting ready for the Trinity test. You know, music takes a big shift and it goes into this kind of very tension-filled, dramatic ticking sound and thumping bass. And it's the first time in the film when you really see the physical bomb.
Yeah.
Everything's up till then has been theories and scribbles on a paper or conversations, but this is the first time you see an actual bomb and the music takes a complete turn there.
Yeah, it's really interesting because that is such a tense scene, but I think even the boardroom scenes later with the hearing mm-hmm. are like, they feel really exciting and tense, even though it's just men talking in a boardroom.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like the music plays quite a key role there in sort of helping build that excitement. Can you tell me a bit about scoring those moments? Because it does feel, quite different.
Yeah, the third act, which is the courtroom scene, Chris called me and he said they were about to edit that third act and he needed a 30-minute piece of called action music, you know, music with a lot of tension and a higher, faster paced tempo. And so he asked me to write a 30-minute piece of music. I did that and I gave him a 30-minute piece of music and then he started to edit the scene to the music and he cut it down to 20 minutes and he sent me the scene and then I wrote music to the scene and then they cut it down again to like 14 minutes.
Do you have a particular, I feel like it's like Ask Me to Choose Your Darlings, but like a particular favorite bit of music, you know, from the film for yourself?
I mean, I would say it's probably the montage in the beginning. Can you hear the music and the journey we took to kind of create that piece of music and how difficult it was to record it live with the musicians. There's a lot of rhythmical tempo changes in there. I didn't think it was going to be physically possible to record it all with the musicians in one take, but we spent 5 days with different techniques of recording it and we were able to finally capture it in one continuous take because we gave the musicians a click in their headphones before it had happened on the page. So discovering that and how the music came alive with the live performances and how it changed the entire scene and the entire music was very, very interesting.
And can you hear the music? I feel like when the film came out, I felt like it was the one everyone was listening to on Spotify. Like all my friends listened to that. Does it ever like surprise you which of the tracks that particularly, I suppose, stand out for audiences?
The way they're featured in the film, obviously that's like such a crucial, inspiring moment in the movie too. And also how you kind of call back to that music in the last end scene in Destroyer of Worlds, in the last scene of the film. You kind of go back to that piece of music again, but now in a more darker, twisted way. But it's always interesting when some of the music gets a life on their own outside of the film.
I know you recently performed Oppenheimer live in concert as well in Los Angeles. Is that something you'd love to do more of?
Absolutely. I think this music and this film is something that actually plays really well in a concert hall. And we spent about 2 months to redo the entire, you know, we didn't rewrite it, but we had to reorchestrate and rearrange the music so we could perform it in one continuous take. It's 2 hours and 43 minutes of music that was recorded under an extensive amount of time. So to be able to, you know, redo it all so we can make it playable in one concert was a lot of work. And I was so impressed with how it sounded live and how well it worked with the movie and the experience of seeing the movie with the orchestra. Yeah. It was beautiful.
That was Ludvig Göransson, and Oppenheimer is out now on home entertainment platforms and is currently storming award season. And now it's time for our final review of the week.
Now's not the time to be running out of gas, you know, bro. We gotta be focused on what we're doing, Ash.
I'm 14. I shouldn't be hungry.
You got a big weight on your shoulders. You carry it well, bro.
They're just some kids, man. What do they know?
Has it got something to do with you?
Get off me, man.
I haven't asked you. What is it that you want?
You know, one day, maybe I could have my own thing.
So that was British thriller Gassed Up. Matthew, can you tell us what this is about, please?
Yeah, so this is a British youth crime drama. It won the Audience Award at the recent London Film Festival. The feature debut from George Amponsah, documentary maker, and it centres on a young kind of a moped street gang in London who whiz about mostly nicking people's phones and wallets. They're being employed by this Albanian crime family, so they kind of give the proceeds to them and get paid. And the central character of this gang is Ash, played by Stephen Udubula, who's in Blue Story. He's basically looking after his young teenage sister because his mother's having problems with drugs, with addiction, and he wants to make enough money so that his mum can go into rehab. And so it's all kind of sort of relatively going well for him, but as you might imagine, then friction starts to happen between the members of the gang. One of the gang members goes too far when they're carrying out one hit. And they find themselves getting in too deep with their Albanian paymasters. Yeah, things start to unravel, and it's all about whether Ash can kind of get out of this situation he's got himself into and resolve things and help out his family.
So it sounds like quite a tense setup. Is it actually tense? Does it play out tense on screen?
Yeah, I mean it's very kinetic. They use there's lots of GoPro footage they've used for the moped scenes. They're kind of like the driving force of the movie. There's quite a lot of those kind of weaving in and around the streets of London. It's tense. It's got a sort of gritty feel to it, but it's also a bit undone by quite a lot of cliches. Yeah, I mean, right from the start, the kind of aerial footage of London, it kind of keys you in to think this is perhaps going to go in quite familiar ways, this story. And it does in many respects. I mean, you are sort of waiting a lot of the time for the kind of the penny to drop and for things to go wrong and people to go too far and that kind of thing. And some of the characters are quite stock, especially the the crime family who's in charge of the moped gang. They seem slightly caricatured at times. It helped my interest. It's got sort of quite a sort of accessible, broad appeal. And I mentioned that the lead actor was in Blue Story, and it certainly doesn't feel as kind of authentic or as deep as that movie. And I haven't seen this show, but I've seen lots of comparisons to Top Boy that have been unfavorable as well. So I thought, it was solid, kind of exhilarating in parts. It feels like it owes a bit to the Fast and Furious franchise. There's a few street races, stuff like that. But it didn't quite come off for me. I think the cliches are laid on a little bit too thick.
Can you see why it won the audience award? Is there anything about it that makes you think, or do you think it was just like that the home London turf just appreciated seeing their city on screen?
Could be partly that, but yeah, I mean, it's very sort of accessible. Feels like it's about the kind of the current moment. It's got a strong sort of youth appeal, kind of a banging soundtrack. It also stars Mae Muller, UK's Eurovision candidate from the last year. Yeah, I can kind of see why it connected with audiences. It's certainly, it's not a difficult or a hard film in that kind of sense. It goes for this kind of intensity, but it's not quite as fully realised as you might hope it would be.
That was Gassed Up, and if you did like the sound of that, that is also in cinemas from Friday. What's your film of the week this week, Matthew? I think it's fairly obvious, but...
The Iron Claw by far. I mean, Occupied City is hugely impressive, but Iron Claw.
I obviously loved it as well. And just to quickly mention that there are actually a few notable films being re-released this week in cinemas, including Pixar's Turning Red, It Happened One Night, and Dune, the 2021 first part from Denis Villeneuve. Those are three very strong films if you fancy going to see an old film. Like, I mean, a real mix there. But Turning Red, obviously, the Pixar film about the girl who turns into a giant red panda, basically, during awkward moments of her adolescence. And I absolutely love that film. It never got a cinema release originally because it kind of came out during the time when the pandemic was still kind of playing havoc with cinemas. And it was one of the few Pixar films in a row that ended up debuting on Disney Plus. But I thought it was such a great film. I love the director, Domi Shi's short film, Bao. I love this film. I love the main character. I love the kind of energy of it, the visual style. Were you a big fan as well?
Oh, God, yeah. It's my favourite Pixar of the last few years. Yeah, I thought it was absolutely terrific. Mm. I loved it.
Yeah, so that's great. And if you fancy actually seeing that on the big screen, for an opportunity, that's out. It Happened One Night. That's Frank Capra's sort of classic rom-com. The first film ever to win the big five Oscars and only sort of one of three films ever to have ever done that. It really sort of set the template for rom-coms, didn't it, as well?
The meet cute screwball rom-com. It's hard to believe that's 90 years old now, still looks pretty fresh. But I mean, it's not my favorite Capra movie, but I've always loved that. I've seen that many times over the years. The chemistry is just fantastic between the two lead actors.
And there's also Dune Part One, as we could kind of call it, the first half of Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Frank Herbert's classic sci-fi novel, and that's back in cinemas. I think, Matthew, am I right in saying you get the sneak peek of Dune Part 2 when you go and see this re-release? I know that's in some places around the world, but I don't know if we're getting it in the UK. I kind of presume we are, but I don't actually know for sure.
I don't actually know. I would guess so, I guess that's the reason they're re-releasing it now, with Part 2 only a month away.
And that was a film that kind of, it did well at the box office, but that came at just the time when we were just kind of easing out of COVID times at the cinema, didn't it? So perhaps it didn't come at the absolute kind of ideal launch point, but obviously still did well, still seemed to be a film that kind of showed people were interested in going back to the cinema, and clearly did well enough to get the second one going, which is coming out very soon. And we do also, it's perfect way to mention that we do have a new issue out right now featuring Dune Part 2, with interviews with Denis Villeneuve, Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, loads more. So if you want to check that out, there's a link to that in the show notes as well for more info. And if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice, which just means you will never miss an episode and it helps others to find us. And you can always contact us either on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But Before we go, just time for a very quick question. What's your favourite performance by a wrestler turned actor?
There's quite a few, actually. I was thinking about this. there's quite a lot to choose from. But I'm going to go for John Cena as Peacemaker, particularly in the show of the same name. I thought he was great in James Gunn's The Suicide Squad, but I absolutely loved the spin-off Peacemaker. I thought he was absolutely fabulous. I always like watching him. I find him very funny. I think he's got a great sort of deadpan sense of humor and comic timing, but he has like lovely chemistry as well in Peacemaker with all the other characters. So he's my number one.
Yeah, I really, really loved Peacemaker as well. I think, again, like you say, there's lots to choose from, but the one that kind of springs to the very front of my mind, and there's a kind of Dune connection here as well, because I mean, he's also in Dune, and this film is also directed by Denis Villeneuve, but is Dave Bautista in Blade Runner 2049, because it's a very, very small role, but really found it really impactful.
Yeah.
And I think Dave Bautista, he's perhaps one of the most surprising wrestlers who's shown like real kind of dramatic chops, isn't he, as well? Yeah. And I mean, obviously he's kind of great and sort of blew us away as Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy when he kind of showed how funny he could be. I think, yeah, he does so much with just a really small role in Blade Runner 2049. And I just love that film as well. So that's going to be my shout.
He makes such great choices as well. You think of the people he's worked with. He's worked with James Gunn, Villeneuve, Miyazaki. He's really on the ball when it comes to which auteurs.
He is, yeah. I really liked him in Knock at the Cabin as well, the Shyamalan film. So yeah, very, very, very clever guy, clearly. But yeah, so that's it from us for this week. But we will be back next week. And thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Yo, this is The Rock kicking it with the refugee camp. And you're about to smell what The Rock is cooking.
Yo, this is strictly a club record dedicated to A-Right who used to stand outside in the cold when the FLEX was spinning at the red zone. Put it down. Let me tie your mountains with not let me in.
Yo, 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 I got 50 Bentleys in the West Indies.
It doesn't matter.
I got a pocket full of cheese and a garden full of trees.
It doesn't matter.
I just won the bingo, bought a crib in Rio.
It doesn't matter.
Cause if you ain't sharing, people ain't caring. Come up in the hood and they take everything you're wearing. Back in the days, it was all about the clubs and so-called thugs used to dance and break.